All right, we're going to officially begin and call this meeting to order. Welcome. Today is Tuesday, September 17th, 2024. This is the City of South Jordan Combined City Council and Planning Commission Study Meeting. And we are thrilled to have members of our Planning Commission here with us tonight and staff. Staff who doesn't usually get to come and hang out with us. You see, I said get. Yes, it's an opportunity. We appreciate you being here. Thanks for being here with us tonight. All of you that are here. My name is Dawn Ramsey. I serve as mayor of the City of South Jordan with this outstanding City Council and Planning Commission and staff. We have the best of the best here tonight. We welcome any, I don't see any members of the public. Oh, here we do. Yes, we do. As soon as I said that, I knew I was wrong. We have one joining us here tonight. We welcome you and any who may watch this or listen to it later. And we appreciate you being here. We've got some folks online too. Welcome. All right, we are going to open tonight's meeting with an invocation by our City Commerce Director, Mr. Brian Priest.
Our kind and gracious Father, thank you for the opportunity we have to meet here in this beautiful city, this beautiful land, that we can discuss those things that are of importance to the residents of the city and the businesses and all those that partake in this in one way or another in this business of the city. And we're thankful for all that we have. We ask you to help us to have a good spirit of cooperation and decorum that we might be able to express our concerns and feelings, and we might be able to have a civil debate if, when necessary. And we say these things humbly in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Priest. All right, I'm going to turn to the council and see if anyone has anything specific that you would like to coordinate tonight. Okay. All right, we're going to move to item D. Just give a quick rundown of our regular council meeting. Just not spelled out. Let's see. It's a fairly light agenda. After public comment, we have three presentation items: a proclamation recognizing Constitutional Convention and Constitution Week 2024. Today is Constitution Day, the 237th anniversary. We have a really cool award recognition that our team will be receiving from the Utah Recreation and Parks Association. It's exciting and it's well deserved, and we are really excited about that. So we'll have some of our Parks and Rec staff here with us that will be part of that. We look forward to that. And then we have an informational presentation on a proposed public safety bond, which will be presented by Salt Lake County. I don't know who exactly will do the presenting. I believe Council Chair Laurie Stringham will be here and Salt Lake County Human Services Director Kellen Colby. So we'll get that presentation tonight. And as part of our training, we'll go through just a reminder about things like this, what we can and cannot do. And just a little teaser, as a city, we can do nothing. We do not weigh in on this at all as a city, as a body, as an entity. But we're going to get some training on that tonight, too, just to make sure that we understand what lanes we're in. We each have our own personal, private lanes, and we have our public hats that we wear. There's a difference with this about what we can and can't do under what hat we're wearing. So anyway, we'll talk about that. And that's it. That's our whole agenda for tonight. So it should be
home by eight.
A light, fairly quick meeting. So
you just cursed us.
No! 7:45.
Yeah, it will be. We're gonna move. So, all right. Anybody have any questions on any of those items? They're fairly self-explanatory. There's not. When Brian prayed for our ability to have a civic debate and then said, if needed, I thought, I don't think tonight it will be. I kind of hope not, because there isn't anything on here that might incite that. But, you know, we'll see. So, thank you. It's always good just in case. Yeah, so thanks. All right. Well, welcome. We're so glad to have you all here with us. It's fun to get to see you, and we just appreciate the great work that you do, the time that you put in, and the value that you bring to our community. It's important, and we are grateful for all you do and for the work that you do, the time that you spend to really be informed and be really good at what you do. Thank you for that. We're going to, right now, turn to our city attorney. Well, who all? We turn you to Greg? We're going to go
Greg's
to Greg
gonna
first.
Greg's going to start with the land use, and then he's going to be excused.
Okay, I'm going to turn it to you, and then I'll let you introduce the rundown. We are going to have our Open and Public Meetings Act Land Use, Ethics, Fraud Reporting, and Utah Political Activities of Public Entities Act Training. It's riveting, people. It's riveting, you know, but it's important.
We made you booklets.
And it's required by law, and they went above and beyond to prepare for it. So,
yes, so
anyway, we'll turn it to our city attorney, Mr. Lewis.
Greg's going to present first. That way he can get home for his wife's birthday in order to stay married. And then I'll be presenting. We'll go through the materials. Basically, most of it's going to be stuff you guys already know, and then at the end we'll do questions. Go ahead, Greg.
Who will be advancing the slide?
You will. Hit the right button.
Okay. When I came to work for the city a few years back, I thought, what can I bring to the city? And I thought, well, I can help you understand how your enemies think. Because I spent my career, more than 30 years, representing what I call LULUs, locally unpopular land uses. And how do we try and weasel our way into a city that really doesn't want us? Okay, and so typical scenario, billboard company comes to me and says, we want 4 billboards in Tocqueville, Utah. And they're fighting us on it. Well, can you imagine this city with the beautiful red cliffs fighting these huge billboards? Yeah, it's shocking. That's exactly right. And so let me tell you how I thought as their attorney when I faced those things. I thought they're going to be all focused on their local ordinances, and what I want to do is trip them up with constitutional issues. I want to say your process was, you denied us equal protection. You denied us a constitutional process. And I would always start with constitutional issues. And I would tell my client, you're gonna go before the Planning Commission and you're gonna lose. And then you're going to appeal to the Board of, back then it was the Board of Adjustments, now it's the Appeal Authority. And you're going to lose. But then we're going to be allowed to go to district court, and you maybe got a 50-50 chance, but then we get to appeal, and that's where we're going to win. Okay, so I just tell you this because the way I've organized this presentation. We're going to talk about the law of exactions, and we're not going to start. I could go right to the local law and tell you this is what the law is and so forth, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to start with constitutional analysis of exactions and then say, okay, how did we get to where we are today? The right one?
Yeah, right arrow.
I promise you, I'm pressing the right arrow.
Oh, there it goes. You got two before.
Okay. when I say an exaction, what is that? A development exaction is a government-mandated contribution of property imposed as a condition of approving a developer's project. So this can come up in a variety of areas. It can come up in conditional use permits. Okay, you think that this is going to have a detrimental effect, and so you impose you impose something on there. Okay, you have a gravel pit coming into the city, and it's a conditional use in the area up there, the base of the mountains, and you impose a buffer. You've basically taken that buffer for public use. But is it allowed? Do you have to take into consideration these amendments? Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Do you have to compensate them for that buffer? And hopefully we'll get to that answer by the end of the few minutes that I have. But that's where we start. And you're all familiar, of course, with these sections of the Constitution. But I want to see now, okay, how has that been applied in the area of exactions? Okay, so this is the case we'll focus on first. This is a 1987 case, Nolan versus California Coastal Commission. It's a United States Supreme Court case. And so when it came down, it was huge news. And what happened in that case is that this family, the Nolans, they owned a bungalow on the beach, and it was old and tired, and they wanted to tear it down and replace it with a new home. And the California Coastal Commission said, fine, as long as you give us an easement for the public across your beach. There was public beach on one side and there was public beach on the other side, and they wanted the public to be able to cross the Nolans beach. Now, I want you to know that I knew this presentation might be boring, so I put a pretty picture of a beach on there.
It's a really pretty picture.
to keep us entertained. So anyway, the Nolans didn't like that, and they took it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court held, and this was huge news at the time, that there must be what they called an essential nexus, a direct relationship between the imposed condition and the development's predicted impact on the community. And applying that analysis, the United States Supreme Court says, we don't see what taking an easement across their beach has to do with whatever impacts this new home is going to have there. And they found that it was unconstitutional to make that demand. It was a taking. So about 5 years later, in a 1994 case, we have Dolan versus Tiggard. This is an Oregon case, Dolan owns a hardware store, and she would like to expand the store, and the city of Tiggard said, fine, you can expand your store, but we want the back of your property about 10 feet for a bike path. And that one went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court said, well, we don't really see how having a bike path, but relying on Nolan, alleviates a concern with this expansion of the hardware store. But then they also took it a step further. They said, an exaction on private property must be roughly proportional to the public burden created by the development. So that means the city has a duty in this analysis to figure out, okay, what is the burden that is on the property? What's it going to cost us? And is this what we're requiring from the developer, roughly proportional to the what we're taking from them? And the Dolan Court said, Supreme Court said, nope, we don't find that there's the essential nexus here. We don't see how a bike path is going to alleviate any of the burdens from expanding the hardware store, and we don't see how it's proportional. The burden that's being imposed on the property is proportional to whatever burden is being raised to the community. So those are the two big Supreme Court cases, and but then a few years later, we had here in Utah, the case of BAM Development versus Salt Lake County. And this is the main case that we look at and saying how Nolan and Dolan were have been applied in the state of Utah for exactions. And in that case, Salt Lake County told the developer, and I think this was out in Ryan's neighborhood.
I live in that neighborhood.
Yeah. So they told the developer that they had to dedicate 45 feet for a road required by UDOT. And then partway through the approval process, UDOT came back and said, our standards have changed and we now need like a 60-foot road through there. And BAM said, no way, that's an additional taking. And they challenged under Nolan and Dolan, and it went to the Utah Supreme Court. And in fact, it went to the Utah Supreme Court three times. And it kept getting sent down and sent down for further rulings by the district court. But in the end, Salt Lake County won because they said this road is tied directly to you're gonna need this road because of this development. It's tied to the burden that is being created by the development in the city. And that it went down one time and then it came up again, and BAM Development said, it's not proportional. And they had all of these calculations and all this stuff, and they were fighting over, you know, it was the battle of the accountants and so forth. And the court just says, we're persuaded that it's roughly proportional. We're not gonna make it come down to the dime or anything else. That's the significance of Nolan. So when you get home and your significant other asks you how your meeting is or was, you can say, well, I learned about Nolan and Dolan and BAM. And that's how you can remember it. But then the Utah legislature.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Just for clarity, I'm curious, in these situations, Nolan, Dolan, and the Utah County one, did the county offer compensation, like monetary compensation to BAM, or they simply said, we need this road access? Was there monetary compensation?
There was not.
Okay, so none of these were offered monetary compensation.
Well, if you go up to Tigard today, you're going to find a bike path. But that's because after Tigard lost, they did offer compensation.
Okay, so initially there was no monetary compensation.
That's,
it was just okay.
That's right.
I'm following. Thank you.
You bet. So after these cases came down, the Utah legislature says we think it would help if we think it would help if we put it in our laws. And so today, if you go to 10.9508. It says a municipality may impose an exaction or exactions on development proposed in a land use application if, and there is Nolan and Dolan and BAM kind of spelled out in very short sentences, an essential link exists between a legitimate government interest and each exaction. Okay, so in BAM, they said, we think the link does exist. You need a road. This development is helping create the demand for the road, and so there's that essential link. And then the next time it came up to the court, they said it's roughly proportionate. Okay, so you can't go wild. You cannot say, I'll just tell you quickly. When Nolan came down, I attended a seminar that was given by, and one of the speakers was one of the attorneys for Nolan. And they came down, and he said to us that the California Coastal Commission was doing this over and over and over again, trying to get public easements. But the Nolans were the first and only people willing to make the legal challenge and so forth, ultimately prevailed. So what do we do when we're considering an exaction? And what is appropriate? And here's the basic analysis. Does the proposed condition or requirement advance some legitimate government function? Okay, so you ask yourself, if we ask this developer to put in a pickleball court in the city park across town.
I'm speaking my language.
That's probably not going to meet that. Is it the kind of issue that local planners should be involved in? We all want pickleball courts, and so I'm not going to weigh in on that, but I'm going to say, what's the essential functions? The more it's centralized in the functions of what our municipality is supposed to do. Road building, public safety, all those kinds of issues are going to be more likely to be upheld by a court because they are an essential function of municipal government. Next, does the proposed condition or requirement solve some problem created by the actual development? Okay, you're getting a gravel pit in the city. Dang, the zoning allows it, okay? And you impose an exaction for the buffer. We've talked about this. And you're now going to be required to put in a buffer of how many feet, and you're going to be required to plant these trees and so forth. In my just estimate, I think that meets Nolan and Dolan because it mitigate some negative aspect of the proposed land use. Next, is there a roughly proportionate balance between the problem and the cure? Is the conditional requirement overkill, or does it fairly balance the duty imposed on the applicant and burdens the proposed development places on the community? And finally, is there a less intrusive way? If there's a problem being proposed by the development, and again, this kind of thing can come up in conditional uses particularly, but it can be in development agreements, and it can be in variances and other things, but is there a less intrusive way to address the burden being imposed by the development? If there's questions, I'll take them. If not, I'm done.
So we got a problem over there. Question.
The most common exaction is in every single subdivision when they dedicate a road. So that is the most common way that we get.
And road is right away. Back to sidewalk, back to sidewalk. The sidewalks moves action, the park strips. And then when we make them put in, if we make them put in trees or we make them put in something like that, that also becomes action. Requirement to pay.
And again, you don't see those really be challenged because they kind of meet the analysis that we've been talking about.
In BAM, it was challenged, and if you drive out there, like I went tonight, you'll be on 35th headed west, and when you hit about 74th west, you'll notice that on the south side of the road, there's an extra lane and a half. And the mayor and Jason are nodding their heads because they have family out by me. Lane and a half of asphalt till you hit the sidewalk and the curb and the houses. And that they were anticipating widening 35th, UDOT was, and so they were preserving the property and making it be improved. And that's the whole fight in the van. And now on any given day, there's 5-10 cars there with for sale signs and stuff because the rest of the road isn't white. That's the only widened spot. And then it's narrow again because they haven't chosen to take out neighborhoods of the church yet. So.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. So on something like that, do they look at the timeline of when that land would actually need to be used? Because that area's been widened since I was in junior high.
Yeah. They don't look at that because the people who originally bought the houses and who paid the price for that, right? Because the developer passes it on. What impact did they bring? So the 100 houses, let's say, I don't know how many there are, 100, that are there and where that development, did they really bring an impact to need the road to be wider? Or is that everybody's impact that drives 35th? Well, it's more everybody's. Yeah. It's your parents' side of the road on the other side of 35th, and it's the mayor where she grew up far to the, not far, but up west a little bit, because everybody's just
it's everyone's impact.
Those 1,500 homes didn't bring the impact, so they shouldn't bear the burden of the public improvement for the general public. Taxes should be raised.
Yeah.
Condemnation costs should be paid to do that.
Greg,
did I summarize that?
Yes, you did.
Are we...
No, you're entirely wrong.
I've been waiting to hear those words for some
reason. Don't get used to it.
Did it matter, like, when UDOT changed the standard? You know, like when an application is already in process, did they have to have their review process in place, or can they do that?
Well, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, but the government standard doesn't matter as much as the impact, articulating the impact of that development.
Okay.
Now, that's where you get into, and legislature has started a mandate. Street width in residential areas can be no wider than, is it 32 now, Brad, last year? 32. Now, our street widths in certain areas of the city have been narrower than that, but they can't be wider. And so legislature's trying to step in where, instead of making everything a fight, just saying, no, we're saying by fiat, it's this for this type of impact, a residential impact.
That is a great question. It raises the question of vesting. You know, when does something vest? And I think it had not vested, but I think it had vested in the developer's mind, but they had not received a final approval. And I think Ryan's absolutely right. They're basically looking at, okay, what is really needed out here? And I think that what UDOT said was really needed carried a lot of weight to the court. You know, UDOT's the big boy when it comes to in this state about how wide roads should be, and so.
I will say, if we change our standards when people are mid-process, we will probably likely always default to when they start their application and not surprise them. When you surprise people, you get more litigation. Which
well,
is full blame it for attorneys.
Well, and I'll just add one more. It's going to sound like I'm kissing up to my boss, but there. Just add one more thing, and that is that there are a lot of dumb cities out there, and that's why I was successful in my career before I came here. Was there were a lot of people doing a lot of dumb things. South Jordan doesn't do dumb things. Well,
not,
I've,
not
you know, we tore down a house once that
had to go.
Shouldn't have been torn down.
We want it. Don't worry, Chief. Don't listen to it.
But I shouldn't have brought that up. Sorry about that. But South Jordan, we have a good city attorney. We have a good city manager. We have good, well-trained planning commission. I work with them all the time, and they're outstanding. And I don't work with you as much, but from, you know, I live here, and from what I...
We're outstanding, too.
Yeah, there we go.
Just ask us.
I'm getting that in
the
minute.
You know, we have... Yeah.
All right. Is there anything...
Sorry, one other. I think you effective... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, and then Patrick has a question.
I think you effectively answered it, but why didn't BAM come back and say, our impact is a 32-foot-wide street, you're projecting into the future, which obviously they were... Why don't you purchase additional land that you need?
The 32 wasn't state law, and
well,
so they were just doing that. And I think that's where, as Greg summed up, the court, BAM tried to, and the court
okay.
said, listen, it's roughly proportional. We're not going to get into every little minutia. It's just up late. The state legislature has been getting into more of the minutia.
Okay.
It's a great question.
Every chance they don't.
Okay. We're aware. We sometimes have to update those ordinances.
So how are development agreements or master development agreements, how's that impacted by this? I mean, so, you know, when we look at it, we'll say, hey, we may see down the road if we're having a big, huge area, we'll say we'll need okay, we'll obviously have the roads going through there. We'll probably need a certain amount of, you know, park space that they're going to have to dedicate. And we may have land for, you know, police, fire stations, what, you know, and other public works, whatever that looks like. Do things change when we get into the MDAs or what can you say about that?
You want to take that or you want me to?
Go ahead.
So with development agreements, this is all applicable with one caveat I would bring up. If as part of the development agreement, there is a rezone, which I think most of the time in the development agreements, it is a rezone. It then becomes, what we've been talking about mostly has been, administrative decisions. When you get into a legislative decision, you remember that the standard on appeal changes from a substantial evidence standard to a, what is it?
Arbitrary, capricious, and illegal.
Yeah, and they're going, a court is almost always going to uphold a somewhat, I mean, you know, as long as it's reasonably debatable that the counsel was not just totally arbitrary and capricious what they did, they're going to uphold what you do in a legislative decision. So if a development agreement comes before the council as part of a overall rezone, you're going to have more latitude and less worry about constitutional takings than if it's an administrative decision.
I'd say there's two parts to go with that. One is it goes in front of the commission now too because of the recent change in state law. And two, these still apply, but they're asking for something too. So Rives got pickleball or gave us pickleball courts. More money toward pickleball courts, a better set. But they got a higher density than otherwise we would have allowed. And so there is some trading that goes on there. We step out of it. Those who attended a very good session at the recent conference by Steve. Steve and I presented on development agreements. We step out of some of our immunities and protections in state law by doing a contract, but they give up some of their ability to go after us too because they're agreeing to it. So unless they can show we deceived them, that we unlawfully use leverage or pressure behind the scenes, threaten them or something, it's a valid binding contract that they're entering into. And so the exaction analysis, I think it's a little more, for lack of a better term, squishy because you're making a deal. So that rough proportionality of a pickleball court in the park, not just park space, but a pickleball court for 2 extra units per acre, how do you really proportional that? Is it amenable to both sides? And then I would say, if you approve 3 or 4 that are similar in a row, keep similar standards. Don't give the farm away to one person and another people away from the schools. Then you start to look arbitrary and capricious. And then we really don't do development agreements. I can't think of any here on an administrative level. If they want the zoning that's in place and they want the rules in place, then file your application, take it through the process.
What about,
a great question.
Yes. What about setbacks or other distances from properties for like...
Those aren't takings.
Those are not considered
takings.
You still
own the land.
So that's a margin. Okay, but it's not taking for another purpose.
Yeah, we don't own it. We don't use it.
Gotcha. Okay, thanks.
Anyone have any additional questions?
Just curious if we have any lawsuits going on with this kind of thing.
What's that?
Do we have any land use lawsuits?
I don't believe we have anything going, and again, I think that's because we have well trained people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is this?
Oh, we don't have any land use lawsuits. Now, last big case involving South Jordan as a city in the land use world was development fees, and that was Banbury versus South Jordan, which created kind of the impact fee laws. And that was, I don't remember, late 90s, I think.
Like,
but that's when South Jordan was more, do you remember, Brian?
I think it was in the 80s.
Was it 80s? It was a long time ago. And that's when South Jordan was much more development averse and didn't do well in that case as far as fees. But it set out how you do impact fees and that you need a study and all that stuff, if I'm remembering that very correctly.
That's correct. I didn't prepare on impact fees, but
no.
We've got something to look forward to in the future.
Yes, we know for next year.
Well, I looked up the case, and I didn't realize BAM was as recent as it was. To me, 2012, somebody younger than me might think that was a long time ago, but I feel like that was not very long ago that case happened. So that's really interesting.
If you want to come see it, we'll cook some burgers.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, Nolan is a recent
it's
case.
It's not too long ago. Yeah.
I'd rather go see Nolan.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to have to read the place.
Awesome.
All right.
Thank you.
Tell Laura
happy
birthday.
Thank you. And please give your wife our best and our love and tell her happy birthday from all of us.
Thanks so much for accommodating me letting me go first. I appreciate it.
This will be far less exciting. I have three videos for you all that we'll talk a little bit about with you at the end.
We have HBO joining us.
That's not the video.
Sorry. That's just the teaser.
My videos are appropriate for all audiences.
G-rated. Thank you.
Well, they're from the state auditor site, two of the three, so.
Oh, they're going to be dry.
Yes, very, very much so. So if you want to stay awake, just start reading the law that we printed for you.
Oh, I knew Ryan was presenting, so I got my
caffeine. Get your caffeine now.
I need my caffeine.
Before you start this training, can I just ask an opinion question?
Yes.
There's no right or wrong answer to this. We don't know this yet. But I'm just thinking of it because I was visiting with Auditor Dougal yesterday at the Capitol. I just saw him and we were talking. He held the door for me and was chatting. And, you know, he's almost done because he ran for a different office and wasn't chosen for that office. And so his time as state auditor is coming to a close. And I'm just wondering, before we launch on this, with a new state auditor coming in, do you expect or could you even speculate that we'll have significant changes in the trainings that are required? Or is it just too soon to know? Or how much discretion does the auditor have?
The required trainings are all in statute. The auditor did push one or two of those. Neil, do you remember when that was? Like three, 4 years
ago?
Mm-hmm. We used to have other required trainings by our insurance when we were with IRMA. The land use was one of those. Now land use required training is for the Planning Commission by statute, but the council doesn't have it. We still think it's a good idea since we do so much here to just, you know, get a little bit every year. And so that's why we do it. I know Auditor Dougal was considered a pretty proactive auditor in the programs and stuff he pushed. I just don't have a sense of those running for his office and how they would be. But I don't foresee any of the statutory required changing or trainings changing. I mean, they're fraud, they're Open Meetings Act, they're things that are regularly violated intentionally or unintentionally, and therefore they'll probably remain, would be my
guess.
Just
wondered what your thoughts were. I haven't given enough thought as to what it could look like. And I know Tina Cannon, who is a candidate, and I don't know the other candidate, but anyway, just wondering.
That would be my guess.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Take it away. We need popcorn for this, by the way. There's like lots of things.
I can get your chocolate
covered.
What is
the Open and Public Meetings Act? It's the state law that ensures government actions and deliberations are openly conducted. Before we continue, keep in mind that this video is an overview and exceptions may exist based on your entity type. We focus on local government, not state requirements. When in doubt, read the law and consult with your legal counsel. So what's considered an open and public meeting? It's when a public body quorum, also known as a simple majority, meets to discuss or act upon government business. It includes the meetings sometimes referred to as workshops or executive sessions. Regular meetings, public hearings, electronic meetings, and emergency meetings are all open and public meetings. Open and public meetings don't include chance or social meetings. A public hearing is a type of open and public meeting where citizens have a reasonable opportunity to speak. Public hearings happen when a government adopts a budget, imposes or increases taxes or fees, or transfers money from an enterprise fund. These meetings have extra notice and posting requirements and won't be addressed in this video. An electronic meeting is a type of open and public meeting that's convened electronically, such as via phone or the internet. Remember, the governing body must adopt a resolution, rule, or ordinance allowing and governing electronic meetings.
And we have
APMA
one.
Adds additional requirements too. An emergency meeting may be held to discuss an urgent matter due to unforeseen circumstances. In order to hold the meeting, the best notice that's feasible is provided of the time, location, and topics to be considered. An attempt is made to contact all governing body members, and the governing body majority approves the meeting. An open and public meeting may be closed to discuss any of the following: a person's character, competence, or health, collective bargaining, litigation, certain real property transactions, including any form of a water right or water shares with specific restrictions, security personnel, devices, or systems deployment, investigations of criminal misconduct, and private or protected information per the Utah Procurement Code, including trade secrets. A closed meeting may be held only if a quorum is present and the meeting was properly noticed. 2/3 of the governing body present at the meeting need to vote yes to close a meeting. Quick math lesson. 2 divided by 3 equals 66.7%. Let's say your governing body has 5 members present at the meeting. If 3 out of 5 members vote yes, that equals 60%, which is not equal or greater than 66.7%, which means you're 1 member short and would need 4 out of 5 members to vote yes. During a closed meeting, a governing body can't interview someone applying to fill an elected position.
That's a South
discuss
Jordan
filling
role, by
a
way.
Midterm vacancy or temporary absence.
Mayor Osborne.
Discuss the character, competence, or health of a person whose name was submitted for consideration to fill a midterm vacancy or temporary absence. Approve any ordinance, resolution, rule, regulation, contract, or appointment. Or take a vote, unless it's a vote on a motion to end the closed portion of the meeting and return to an open meeting. When a governing body closes a meeting, the following must be publicly announced and entered into the minutes of the open meeting at which the closed meeting was approved: the reason or reasons for holding the closed meeting, the location where the closed meeting will be held, and the vote of each member of the governing body either for or against the motion to close the meeting.
So I have some push pause, a couple things there. So the filling midterm vacancy was a South Jordan rule because of when Mayor Osborne was appointed, when Mayor Money stepped down, and some legislators got annoyed by how that was done then. As far as what's required in South Jordan, because the mayor signs an affidavit on behalf of the meeting saying it was done properly, we have adopted a signature sheet for the closed meeting, so if you're ever in one, that we require every participant to acknowledge or to sign that acknowledges that it is a closed meeting, one, and they understand what that means, and two, that they agree to keep everything in the closed meeting confidential pursuant to state law. And then the last thing on closed meeting is, while you can't vote in closed meetings, the whole purpose of closed meetings is to talk about certain items. So if they're talking about hiring or firing the city attorney, character and competency of personnel, I'll just use that as an example, that what they can do is give an indication of kind of what they're thinking, discuss the issues and everything. In the end, they can close the meeting, go into an open meeting, and then they take their vote. So you can have frank discussion. You can know about where everybody is. You just can't do a formal act in there. And that's the purpose of the meeting, is to discuss, do we want to sell this piece of property? Do we want to buy this piece of property? Do we want to hire or fire this individual? And so understanding where each other are at is totally appropriate in that meeting. In fact, that's the purpose. You just can't call for a vote other than the end of closed meeting. Some people get really nervous about what happens in there, and it's for frank discussion. Otherwise, why close it?
Closed meeting is discussing a person's character, competence, or health, or security personnel, devices, or systems deployment, or several other exceptions, mostly related to state bodies or project entities. No recording or minutes are required. However, the presiding member needs to sign a sworn written statement stating such. If the closed meeting is held for any other reason, a recording must be made, which includes date, time, and place of the meeting, names of members present and absent, and names of all others, except where disclosure would infringe on the confidentiality necessary to fulfill the original purpose of closing the meeting. Regular open and public meetings require 24 hours notice. The public notice includes the meeting agenda, date, time, and place. Public meeting agendas need to include reasonably specified topics to be considered, with each topic listed under a separate agenda item on the meeting agenda. The governing body may not consider a topic in an open meeting that wasn't on the agenda. If a new topic not on the agenda is raised by the public during an open meeting, the governing body may discuss the topic. However, final action may not be taken on the new topic during that meeting.
On the noticing it, we notice all of ours out a year. So in December, you notice the next year's and everything. So any meeting we have that's not according to that schedule, we call a special meeting. And we still do 24 unless there really is emergency, like maybe someone trying to blow up their neighborhood. I think that was our last emergency meeting.
Did you notice in the video when it said emergency meeting, it went boom?
Yeah. And it had a fire truck. Yeah. So, I mean, it's right there. And then on this part, we have public comment at the beginning of all of our city council meetings. You could hold an item over for that, and that's what they're talking about. That's not our practice. Our practice is to get with the appropriate staff, and then if it's something that comes back, it comes back as an order of due course. So.
Additionally, entities holding regular meetings scheduled in advance over the course of the year need to provide annual notice of the entire year's meeting schedule. The notice must include date, time, and place for each meeting.
Notice is posted on the public body's website, in a public location such as the location where the meeting will be held, and on Utah's public notice website in accordance with Utah Code 63G-30-102.
Typically, posting on the public notice website is done by the records officer, recorder, or clerk. However, it's the governing body's responsibility to ensure notice is provided. State Archives has prepared a training manual and quick guide for owners and posters, as well as training videos that can be accessed at their website, archives.utah.gov. Written minutes and a recording are kept of all open meetings, with few exceptions. Written minutes include the date, time, and place of the meeting, the names of members present and absent, the substance of all matters, names of citizens providing comments, the substance of the comments provided, any information.
So this is something that's come up lately. It's the names of everyone that makes comments. We also ask for address, and that generally know if they're residents of South Jordan or not. If they decline, I would suggest not pushing them on that.
We never have.
And we never have.
Most people give it, some don't, or they'll give their address and not say their city or whatever. But in general.
Yeah, there have been bodies around the country that have chosen to fight that. Mr. Sharon, who used to work here and works for Harriman, was showing a presentation of where one city escorted a person out because they wouldn't give their address. I think you were in that presentation stuff, and they're facing lawsuits and stuff. So what Utah requires is that they do share their name. And so if they don't want to share their name, then we can say, that statute, we want to hear what you say after you share your name. So, but if they're not giving their address, you can ask them, do you live in the city and stuff, but we wouldn't escort them out.
We have never had a problem with it.
A body member request be entered into the minutes or recording, and a record by individual member of each vote taken. A body with elected members must record each vote in list format, by category for each action taken by a member, including yes votes, no votes, and absent members next to each member's name. A recording must be a complete and unedited record of all open portions of the meeting from beginning to end, and be labeled with the meeting date, time, and place. All or any part of an open meeting may be independently recorded by any person in attendance if the recording does not interfere with the conduct of the meeting. Pending minutes means 3 minutes of an open meeting in draft form subject to change before being approved by the public body that held the open meeting. Pending minutes must contain a clear indication, such as a draft or pending watermark, that the governing body hasn't yet approved the minutes and that the minutes are subject to change until the public body approves them. Approved minutes means written minutes of an open meeting approved by the public body that held the open meeting. Entities must establish and implement procedures for the public body's approval of written minutes. Public meeting pending minutes, approved minutes, and recordings are public records under GRAMA. Any individual who publicly presents information relating to an item on the public body's meeting agenda must provide a copy of the information for inclusion in the public record. make pending minutes available to the public within 30 days. Within 3 business days after approving written minutes of an open meeting, make approved minutes and any public materials available at the Utah Public Notice website, the entity's primary office, and the entity's website. Within 3 business days after holding an open meeting, make an audio recording of the open meeting available to the public for listening.
And because we like you, you don't have to take the quiz and we'll still give you the certificate. There is a quiz. I did pass it. Any questions on open meetings? Please.
It indicated that social meetings are not required to be noticed, but I was under the impression that our bylaws actually prohibited that. I got that from Mr. Gitch, and I really trust him. So,
Did you guys adopt separate bylaws?
We haven't adopted separate, that we would just follow the city council's adopted procedures.
Yeah. So if there are social meetings that we know about, in other words, a conference or something like that, we will do a notice of potential quorum, and we would do the same for the planning commission. But if it's a social meeting, let's say in another phase of life, I heard there was a Korean festival this weekend in the city, or Korean festival down at the community center. We don't reasonably anticipate, you guys may all intend to go, but we're not going to notice. They may show up to that or the city's fun run or Summerfest. Like, who went to some part of Summerfest this year? You know, if let's say you had a quorum, we wouldn't necessarily do that. And that's the social ones I think they're talking about. Reasonably anticipated, like if you go to a conference or something, then we would, because I wouldn't so say those are purely social.
What if I had a barbecue?
We would notice it.
Okay.
Yeah. Councilmember Sheldon has had a few of those over the years where he's invited senior staff and the council, and we do notice those as a potential quorum because we know about it. It's a specific invite list, and so we would do that. Yep.
Good thing I wasn't wrong.
100%. I knew you wouldn't be. You're always on top of it.
All right, we ready for ethics?
No.
Is that a squirm I saw?
I spent 2 of my 4 ethics training, so.
I would just say most of that open meeting stuff, our system of doing things, checks all the boxes of time, place, who's here, who's not, the voting, all that stuff. It's all on forms, and so as we go through it, Ms. Kirkston's office has done everything to kind of ensure that just by process, we're going to follow the law.
By way of note, we don't close the doors to the council chamber and we don't close the doors in here. If there's a whole gaggle of people out talking in the hall and it's loud because they, you know, are out there after whatever just happened and whatever, we still don't close the doors. We'll have somebody go out and have people move away a little bit or
move
something.
Move them upstairs.
But we keep the doors open during our public meetings.
Space probably impossible.
Oh, well, don't give me that much power. I pushed it, it's not plugged.
You broke it already, Ryan?
I told you not to give it to me.
Welcome to the Office of the State Auditor's video on ethics and nepotism for municipalities. In this video, we will provide a basic overview of Utah State's ethics and nepotism laws as they apply to municipalities. This training is not comprehensive. Rather, our goal is to provide you with enough information to determine if an unethical situation exists and subsequently work with legal counsel to ensure compliance. If you have any questions about this video, please contact our office. Ethics laws are designed to balance establishing the faith and confidence of the people in the integrity of their government without denying a public officer or employee opportunities available to all other citizens to acquire private economic or other interests, so long as this does not interfere with their full and faithful discharge of their public duties. For these and other reasons, you will find that laws generally do not require a public official or employee to abstain from a vote or discussion where a real or perceived conflict may exist. Laws often only require that the public official or employee disclose the potential conflict of interest. a law may allow an individual to participate in a vote or discussion. However, generally, nothing would prevent an individual from choosing to abstain from a vote or discussion if they feel it is in the best interest in preserving their and the entity's reputation. Keep in mind that a local government is free to enact more restrictive policies than provided by law. To effectively deal with a conflict of interest, it is important to first identify potential conflicts and second, to appropriately respond. Utah Code identifies potential conflicts of interest. It may also be necessary for a municipality to identify potential conflicts that are unique to them and adopt policies that are more restrictive than Utah Code. A conflict of interest by itself does not mean that a public official has abused their position, but that there exists the potential for abuse. Responding involves determining when to disclose a potential conflict or abstain from a vote, discussion, or decision. Utah Code defines the required response in some circumstances. However, an entity may adopt policies that are more restrictive than the law. When dealing with conflicts of interest, not all laws are applicable to all types of local governments. On your screen, you can see ethic-related laws as they apply to municipalities. Regardless of local government type, these laws are applicable to public officials, both appointed and elected, employees, and full-time committee members, whether they are compensated or not. We are going to highlight several conflicts of interest that are included in Utah Code. You will find that some of these conflicts are explicitly forbidden by the code, while others may be allowed with proper disclosure.
So one thing we want to note here, and I was just pulling up, recent change in state law requires us to post these conflict of interest forms for you on the city's website. So you each do them every year, we send them, you electronically fill them out and sign them, and then once received, within a certain amount of time, we will post those. So if you're wondering why, depending where you live, call Senator Fillmore or Representative, whichever representative of yours, because it was a state law requirement.
Do they have to do the same?
I don't think I ever have.
Yeah, I don't think we
do. So it covers elected officials. So if you're elected, is the requirement under House Bill 80 that changed this last legislative session, that now they require for the clerk to post them on the city's website for anyone to have access to the
mayor.
Well,
it's elected and candidates, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you just have to post it. So you guys don't get the conflict forms? I know all the employees do. We send a whole bunch out.
Employees and elected.
To help make sense of these conflicts and the different allowances granted by Utah Code, you will find a downloadable table in this section, which presents the conflicts in a slightly different format. Personal investments that create conflict between personal interest and public duties are allowed with proper disclosure for municipal officials and employees, while the disclosure of private or protected information is explicitly forbidden. The acceptance of gifts is also forbidden for all types of local government entities, with some small exceptions. If the gift is an occasional, non-monetary gift valued at less than $50, a publicly presented award, a bona fide loan made in the ordinary course of business, or a political campaign contribution, then the gift is allowed. There are three types of conflicts that are allowed with proper disclosure. They are assisting with a transaction where an official or employee receives or agrees to receive compensation for assisting a person or business with a transaction involving the entity, a person who is an officer, agent, or employee or owner of a substantial interest in a business subject to regulation by the local government entity for which that person works, and a person who is an officer, agent, employee, or owner of a substantial interest in a business which does or anticipates doing business with the local government entity for which that person works.
Pause that for a sec. No, the answer to your question is HB 80 is only for those of us that are part of a political subdivision, not for legislators.
Yeah. And we're looking at more, I think it also added you because it says land use authority.
Land use authority.
And so on some issues, you are the land use authority. On others, the city council is. And so we will be adding you. So
yeah.
Look for it in your email box.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's really convenient.
It's very interesting. It's very interesting.
That only applies to us.
That was a good question. Yeah. And it was easy to find the answer. And I went, okay.
And what's the gift limit the legislature can receive?
It's also 50.
Is it 50 for them?
So I'm curious. It says,
and that hasn't changed in the 18 years I've been here. I've been asked about inflation and stuff. It's always been 50.
What about
who values the $50?
Tickets must be pretty cheap.
Upper bowl.
So, for example,
the U.S. government
Give you,
values it.
Who does?
The U.S. government. $50, $50.
I was going to say, I think I've heard of one use case where someone gave options in a business for a penny per share and got 5,000 shares for it. And that's like,
yeah, that would clearly be fraud.
Okay.
I mean, unless the business is your kid's lemonade stand, or, I mean, for a real business, I mean, there's a common sense factor to this, and that's what the courts would be looking at.
Okay.
On the last slide, it talked about $50 gift, but then it also said you could do campaign contributions. I've never run
those are gifts.
Right. Is there a threshold or a ceiling for that?
On campaign?
Yeah.
I'm not big into that world. But
I'm not worried about it because I've never gotten
federal
anything.
Candidates there are. I don't
I was going to say.
So local, you can get whatever they give you.
I think so.
Yeah.
But you have to disclose this.
For
that.
Sure.
And you're held accountable by the voters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, federal, there are some, and that's what that Citizens United case was all about and stuff. But.
And I found out from a legislator today that I was visiting with at the county building that her team filed her campaign finance donations 2 days late. They had one late one that came in, and so they filed it 2 days after the deadline and thought it could kind of count toward the next deadline. It was counted as late, and you have to pay a 10% penalty to the state for what that was. So she's sending a check for $12.67 as a penalty. But just know that while we're talking about it. Anyway, that's how it works.
And we as a city try to stay pretty... I mean, there's no interest in me really learning the campaign stuff because I don't advise anybody in their campaign capacity. If there's a question about that, that'd be between you and the Lieutenant Governor's office or the county elections.
Hannah is a good resource to answer questions.
Yeah, to answer questions, but even on the campaign contributions, give legal advice, give any advice to you of what things are. We have to be very careful of that because... as much as you're all our friends and we work with you all, once you step out of your, or better said, once you step into your campaign mode and hat, then we have to take a step back from our interactions. Like I know several of you, when you run, you've asked for some documents presented in city council or whatever so you could show. We give you a grammar request form, you fill it out, and we'll give you the documents. You know, that's whereas usually we'd say, yeah, take these to your constituents. But once you're in a campaign mode, then we kind of change that relationship just by necessity of law.
So store your stuff while you're doing it.
Yeah, if you store your stuff, if it was an open meeting stuff, you can certainly use it.
When a violation of
You look like you want to say city manager.
I mean, I can ask you later. I'm just curious if you think we'll see a legislative change since the state is refusing to release conflict of interest forms currently.
Yeah, they are.
I doubt it. I doubt it.
Well, it's for Governor Cox's cabinet. They're not releasing.
Yeah.
I just thought it's the most public document there is.
I know the last time they got into some grandma issues, they changed the grandma law. So.
That's why I wondered if you thought we might see a change.
I haven't heard of any coming, but the bills haven't started to heat up yet, so we'll see when they heat up. But luckily, since that's not our world, I don't
this week
get too invested.
Yeah.
Ethic law takes place. There are several potential penalties. These generally apply to all types of local governments. The penalties are removal from office or dismissal from employment, being charged with a felony or misdemeanor, depending upon the value of compensation, conflict of interest, or assistance, and depending upon the violation, the rescinding or voiding of a contract, without returning any part of consideration received by the entity. In addition to laws preventing or limiting conflicts of interest, Utah Code 52-3 forbids acts of nepotism. No public officer may employ, appoint, vote for, or recommend a relative for employment. Additionally, no public officer may directly supervise an appointee who is a relative. You can see a list of the relationships the law defines as a relative on your screen. There are several exceptions provided for in the law. The most important exception is that a relative may be employed if they are the only person available, qualified, or eligible for the position. Great job. You finished the ethics and nepotism laws video.
We're not going to make you take the test.
I have a question.
You used to.
I know.
I don't have a problem with this, but at the city employee barbecue last week, I met somebody who was the spouse of somebody that works for our city. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a couple years ago, we had a rule that nobody related could work for our city. When did that change?
So there's a couple of things with that.
Because it used to be pretty strict. I was trying to get somebody to apply and they had an uncle, uncle's uncle.
Yep.
And you said no.
So there's two parts to that answer. The first part is, I can't control when employees work here, meet, fall in love, and get married. Mm-hmm. So we have several sets of spouses that work for the city currently,
so we're
who were not married when one or the other got hired.
That's fair.
So that's the answer to one of those questions. So we do have several people that have gotten, and I didn't mean to embarrass anyone. I'm
no,
sorry.
We're not pointing any fingers.
It's one of the answers to that question.
The
other part of that is about a year ago, the city did have a nepotism policy that was much more stringent than the state law. And one of the things that I did as the city manager was make some adjustments to that. So our current nepotism policy is completely compliant with the state statute of what you just were trained on. Mm-hmm. And I softened some of the additional city requirements. So for example, we would never have allowed a married couple or a mother-daughter to be crossing guards. But we have such a hard time filling our crossing guard allocations that I made a change that said relatives could work as crossing guards, which has been great. We've been able to have couples or, you know, sisters or whatever work at an intersection together, and it's really been good. The same with hiring some of our part-time seasonal workers. It has been very difficult to get employees as part-time seasonals at Mulligan's and in our parks department. But so often we would have a young person who had a brother or sister that would also like to work for the city.
Right.
And so I've changed that it now allows for that to happen.
We could hire one and not the other and say, sorry.
And now I'm able to hire one at Mulligan's and one in the parks department, and it's great. And it doesn't violate the state statute. So I think the situation I'm familiar with that you're referring to, if that were to happen today, I believe that we could make that higher now. I have a whole very complex flowchart that if somebody comes to me and says, can my cousin work here? I have a series of questions, and if it's within a different department, so if you work in public works and your sister wants to come work in finance, we can do that. There are some exceptions. None of your relatives, because of state law, I can't hire them, so I can't hire any of your kids to work at Mulligan's. None of my family in any way, shape, or form can work for the city in any department because of my role. Same holds true for the city attorney's office.
So like for a couple of departments, we've said we have enough influence on everything. So the city attorney's office, when we were doing this, I just said...
We've carved out some that just said...
I will never hire
manager,
anybody.
City attorney, who else can
like
us?
The and risk manager.
Human resources.
HR.
There's a few places we've just said that this creates a conflict we're uncomfortable with. But by state law, we could certainly do that.
But,
for example, years ago before our policy, my sister was hired. She still works here. She now works in Raymond's department. And it's just that when there's an issue that involves her department, there's legal issues, we have to now step lighter and we have to consider that.
But even if, you know, if Chief Carr had a nephew that wanted to come work at Mulligan's, that'd be fine. We could do that now.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that the chief's going to have influence or supervisor. Yeah, it was. I believe it involved the fire department and a different department in the city, and now that wouldn't be a conflict.
I'm like, come on.
But my niece applied at the rec center when she was 16. She's graduated from college now, but she applied at the rec center when she was 16 and wasn't able to work there, and she still wouldn't be able to if she applied today.
Because you're elected, right? Okay.
So, yeah, we're not as stringent and restrictive as we once were. Mm-hmm. We are still very compliant with the law, and we watch it very closely.
We're more strict than the law.
We have made it to open the door for a lot more people,
yeah.
Which has really helped us with some recruitment and some
tough
to fill positions.
I just was like, something's shifted.
No, but we do. I think there's 9 or 10 married couples that work within the city. And several sets of siblings, some that like attorney loose.
Some predated
loose.
Our
it,
earlier
it predated
policy,
the more stringent policy.
Yeah. So years and years ago, we just followed exactly what the state law. Under city manager's authority through his contract and through the city code, Gary Walcott decided to basically just say no relatives. It was very strict. Dustin, we looked at that about a year ago, and we mapped it all out. We used a whiteboard and a half, and,
and
lots of brain cells.
If you ever want to, you're welcome to sit down. I'll show you the very complex flowchart that I used to make the call.
I trust you.
But yeah, it's there, and we follow it.
And for the record, I didn't know my niece applied at the rec center until she was told she couldn't work there. She called me.
But now she could work at the rec center because it's not our thing.
County. Yeah, right. Now she could, right. But. She called and said, hey, I applied for the rec center, and they told me I can't work there because I'm related to you. I said, that is correct. I wish I had known you were applying. I would have told you not to apply. So, yeah.
Just because you said elected and we're appointed, I want to make sure I'm not in a conflict with the city.
You're not in a conflict.
We know
we've already ran that whole
and
scenario.
I will protect that my son's employment, and I would happily step aside.
No, we've looked at all of those issues.
Okay.
It's all good. Yeah, there's no worry there.
He's so great, by the way.
I just want to make sure I don't get him in trouble.
No,
or me in trouble.
You made your deal, Dave.
Yeah.
If Mr. Gedge ran for office and were elected, would his son have to be dismissed?
No.
Okay.
It'd be like
he's a current employee.
Yeah, it'd be like my sister and I would just continue. But if I ever left and my sister left under those rules, the other one I couldn't come back.
Now, if a current employee runs for elected office and gets elected to the city, they have to resign their position with the city.
That's been in our.
But that's been in our
since I got here in 06.
It predates me from a long time.
So on that line question, then we all know Katie Olson's running for office on the county level. That doesn't
affect that because it's not an elected position with the city.
So
now,
she
if she was running for city,
boss. Right?
Yeah, if she was running for the city council, that would be.
I mean, I knew it was okay or something would happen, but so city level, a city employee cannot run, but they can run for other.
They can run. They could run for council seat. And if they get elected, they have to resign their position with the city.
For example, Mayor Riding in West Jordan, he was their director of facilities, public works. When he won, he basically retired a day or two before he took office as mayor.
But if they run for a position in a different city, let's say an employee lived in Harriman and they ran for council there, it's totally fine. Or if they run for a county seat or a state seat.
Council.
Only one of these six positions, if they lived in the city, would they have to get their job.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, last video. I know you're riveted. I don't know where the jaunty music went in the last one. The other got cheaper on that one. This one is a video from the recent conference a week and a half ago. It's Justin Lee, one of the deputy directors at Utah League City and Towns. Formerly from the Lieutenant Governor's office. And he is talking, and we're hitting him at mid-hour-long speech. We're hitting just a small bit of it. So he's talking about the public entities, something, and act. It's right here. It's called PAPIA. It is the Public Activity or Political Activities of Public Entities Act. And basically, this one becomes important right now during election season with ballot propositions, bonds for schools, stuff like that, in that the city as an entity and you in your city capacities cannot weigh in, spend money, time, effort on
those items of general public concern that are going to be before you. We're having a presentation about one of those later tonight where the county wants to give the public, and going to a lot of public places, give them information, for example, get their information out in the public. Now, what you can do is listen. What you can do is, in your personal private capacities, contact your county council member, talk it through to understand it better, just like anybody else can, right? I happen to live in the same county council district as Councilmember Zander and the people on the west side. So we'd call our county council representative or one of the at-large and ask the questions if we wanted to. But that's on our own time and our own way. What we couldn't do is call Chief Carr and say, hey, what's your feelings on this, Chief? How does it affect South Jordan? Chief Carr would be acting in his chief capacities, and the city of South Jordan cannot spend resources and time. What I'd encourage you to do tonight after the presentation is thank the presenters, I believe it's Chair Stringham and a staff member, for their time, and invite any member of the public, including members of the council in their personal public capacity, not in their city capacity, to reach out to them on their own time. I would be highly cautious if I was an employee here, which I am, or a city official, to talk to the county people here at City Hall, because it just looks like we're on city time, even though it's kind of after hours. I just save that for the right time where no one can be accused, being accused of violating PAPIA. Justin will talk about what the sanctions are, up to criminal charges. Usually they're fines. In fact, I believe in his presentation talked about some, he said, I'm sorry for those in the room that I've fined in the past, because he's fined a few of the local elected. So we'll watch that. We're catching him kind of mid-sentence here. And grateful for all the work IT did in clipping out these videos from longer presentation. But you'll just hear him roll, and that's kind of the introduction of where he's at. So these are examples of things on ballots.
We have a public safety bond in some counties. We have school district splits going on. We have zap and wrap reauthorization in multiple counties. We have school district bonds. I know there are local referenda and other bonds, other ballot questions in your areas. So want to talk about a few things that can get you in trouble. There's things that can both get you in jail and have you pay fines if you are not careful. And so we want to keep you out of jail and not paying fines. And so we're going to talk about Political Activities of Public Entity Act for a minute. So a public entity includes the state and each state agency, municipalities, so all of you, and government interlocal cooperation agencies, which is the League of Cities and Towns. So this applies to most of us here in the room. A ballot proposition includes constitutional amendments, initiatives, referenda, bond approvals, or other questions submitted to voters. So that's what we're talking about and who we're talking about. Here's the quick and simple answer. Unless specifically required by law, a public entity, so that's all of us, may not make an expenditure from public funds for political purposes or to influence a ballot proposition.
That expenditure of public funds includes your time, because you're being paid, compensated. I know it's not a high hourly wage for the stipends you all receive, but whereas you're compensated, you don't want it to look like you're on city time. So I wouldn't talk to anybody in the building. I wouldn't use my title and stuff.
Now, the distinction between political purpose and ballot proposition, political purpose, very specifically, definitionally in the code, means campaigning for or against candidates. Influencing ballot propositions is exactly what it sounds like, influencing ballot propositions on the ballot. So, unless required by law, can't use public resources
this is
to
Justin.
Influence ballot propositions or candidates. Okay? That's the simple answer. Simple penalty, each public official, here's the monopoly problem, who violates this is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. So don't do it. You don't want to be guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. Simple email answer, because there is a separate thing. Over the years, one of the things that we ran into in Lieutenant Governor's office and also in...
He was the director of elections for Lieutenant Governor for years, and so he was the one levying the fines, doing all that for Lieutenant Governor.
Counties, was that the biggest way people have violated the code or have gone around the code was through the email process. And then there's a question of, is that really a public expenditure? because it's sort of a sunk cost. You've already got the email there. What do we do about that? And so there was a law passed that says a person may not send an email using the email of a public entity for a political purpose or to advocate for or against ballot propositions. So very specifically, don't use your email, your public email, to campaign either for candidates or for or against ballot propositions.
By public means
and
city
simple email.
Email
penalty is fines in this case. So after giving the person notice and a chance to be heard, the lieutenant governor shall issue a fine of $250 for a first violation. I apologize to any city officials that I may have fined when I was in that office. Yes, there are some in the room. And $1,000 multiplied by the number of violations for subsequent violations. So if you use your email, not a Class B misdemeanor necessarily, but you could get fined. Now, with all these, there are more complex answers. There are exclusions. There are different scenarios where you could share certain information, where you can post certain things, and we don't have time to go through all of it right now. So the ULCT is releasing a fact sheet walking through the specifics and the exclusions in the code, and also coming up soon,
right here
factual
in your
information
book.
About the Constitution Amendment.
Page 1 of 4.
Those are
going to
be two
yep.
separate documents. So
that's
this
the fact
Friday
sheet.
In our Friday Facts email, we're going to send out the rules about what you can and can't do under the political activities of public.
And if you clicked on it in your Friday Facts, you probably can get into it because of our firewall, but we can make that go through if you ask.
For specifics about what may be happening in your city.
You're killing me. I can't read anything.
I don't even check Friday Facts.
Your attorney whether carefully and very sure what you're doing is appropriate. Quick cautionary answer, make sure your facts are facts. The law does allow facts to be shared. The thing that I've learned over the years, having received dozens of complaints around this in my previous job, is that one person's facts are another person's advocacy. I'll give you the ridiculous example. If this school bond does not pass, the apocalypse will start. Now you laugh, and it's true, that's ridiculous. But when you've spent time and effort on something and you're like, we need to get this through, that's the mindset that sometimes creeps in. If we don't pass this, everything falls apart. That's not quite a fact. So be careful about what you share. The facts are facts. Now, there's a political answer here too, and we're running short on time, so we'll go through this pretty quickly. Nothing in the chapter prohibits you as a public official from speaking, campaigning, contributing personal money, or otherwise exercising your First Amendment right for political purposes or, again, for or against a ballot proposition. So what that means is in your individual capacity, when you're not using city resources, when you're not in City Hall necessarily, you can say what you want to. You can say what you want to on your personal Facebook pages. There's a whole law. We could talk about that. And Jared Tingey did a great webinar on that. You can do what you want to on your individual time. You just can't do it using public resources. So with that, I'm going to bring up something that's become big in the room politically, and that is Constitutional Amendment D. There was a special legislative session.
I think we can end here. So that's been held up by a court anyway and stuff.
And now the Supreme Court's going to decide.
Yeah,
it's going
yeah.
to Supreme Court.
So we'll see what they say on that.
Utah,
I think they hear it tomorrow.
Yeah. The one thing I think we should be aware of is your title is not... It's not a political, or it's not property of the city. And so if Mayor Ramsey decides to endorse a candidate and they put Don Ramsey, South Jordan Mayor, that does not violate PAPIA. Or Jason McGuire, South Jordan Council Member, that does not violate, because the title is not using the government time, resources, money. That's a title you were elected and given. It is your title, and that goes with you. So any questions about PAPIA? I think tonight you're going to see some examples when the county presents of how some people might see what they present as facts and others might argue they're persuasive. In our minds, it doesn't matter as long as we don't weigh in on it. If the county crosses a line, they're going to be answerable to whoever, and it's not
That's
our place
problem.
To argue with them. We want to give people who are trying to educate the public time, and if somebody else comes in to educate about a certain thing, the mayor, Dustin, we look at those, and then we give them the time on the agenda that they need. But what we won't do is encourage you to weigh in as a council on those things.
So when we have this presentation tonight, is it out of line for us to ask a question for clarification?
I wouldn't ask anything.
Okay.
Because your clarification could cause someone who's on, who is opposing it, let's say, or supporting it, to think you're taking a position and advocating. You don't want your question to be misunderstood. And further, the proper place to ask all of our questions and stuff would be in our individual capacity. And once you're sitting on that dais, you're never in your individual capacity. So I would just thank them for their time and then make contact with the appropriate county representative after the meeting.
On the question of like providing facts, so we have the Zap Tax coming up for renewal. Would the city be able to do like a Facebook post saying, did you know that South Jordan receives $20,000 in Zap Tax, and just leave it at that? We're not saying, you know, renew the
yeah.
Zap Tax, but
I mean,
are we able to provide information?
I'd be careful how I said like the did you know type stuff,
yeah.
But I'd say information about South Jordan Zap
allocation.
Yeah. To do 2024 X amount, 2023 Y amount. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine because that's all facts. The did you know, any characterization is where I start to get
that's where
less
you would cross that line.
Yeah.
So I am aware of an example of a blatant violation of FPIA, and I don't know if they tightened it up after this, but in 2013, there was a city in our school district, it was not South Jordan, it was a different city in our school district, that was opposed to the bond that Jordan District had. It was the bond that failed in 2013, but one of the cities actually put an insert in their mailer, in their water bill, opposing it and telling their residents to vote no for it.
They obviously didn't have Ryan looking at
it. And they didn't, and it didn't pass, but it's a, I mean, it still shocks me. I still go, whoa, you know, and I didn't know about that till later. I don't live in that city, and I wasn't part of that bond campaign. But yeah, it's that was real, and every resident in that city got a mailer in their insert from the city saying, Don't support this, vote against
and
it.
And I'd have to look up if it tightened up after that or not. But clearly right now, if that happened, there would be fines going up.
Would they get a fine for each mail? Would it be a violation?
Possibly.
There goes
I mean, I don't want to speculate.
That's
like,
60,000.
I just wouldn't want to be the city who did it.
Right. And I think a lot of some of the smaller communities around have, not only have they all grown, but I think everybody's become a little more sophisticated in the last 11 years and has a better understanding. I don't think we, I mean, you might see that somewhere here, but you wouldn't, I don't think you'd see that here with the communities in our area happen again, but it did in 2013 and it was.
I'll say this, please feel free. I told Chief Cardis earlier today, I told the mayor this, and the mayor was already hit up about this at a meeting she and I were. Where people from the county would love the support of mayors in their individual capacity and stuff. And you can say on the advice of the attorney, while I'm here doing city business, and Chief Carr, I mean, his perspective would be always city business. You know, if you ask me, I'm going to say the same thing on my own advice. I can't give you my opinions on this because I can't step out of my role as your attorney. Can't step out of his role as your chief. Same with Chief Dawson or Chief Lesner. We just can't ever step out when we interface with you on that level. And so on the advice of the attorney, and when you get asked if you're in a public setting at all, or if they say, what does your city think about it? The city doesn't think about it. The city's great with whatever the voters decide. Now you individually have an opinion, and as long as you characterize that, great. You'll never see us weigh in. Several of our electeds have endorsed, supported, contributed campaigns into initiatives in the referendum. Great, do that. Just don't bring the city entity into it.
Who's making the presentation this evening? Does this law not apply to them?
Salt Lake County. And if their attorneys have approved their presentation, they can defend it.
Cool.
Because counties included.
I'm going.
Yes. Yep.
We may find out in the news in a couple weeks.
We looked at their presentation. I'm not completely comfortable. I'll go on the record with their presentation from the standpoint of if my people were presenting it, but not my not my zoo. They get to defend.
They have attorneys that will approve or not approve what they put out
there. We want them to be able to get out to the public. It's a balancing act with the forum we have. And so if other people want to talk about it too, we probably give them equal time. Sorry, Councilmember Zandri.
We can't control what the county presents, but we can control what we say or don't say in response.
And we could tell them, no, they can't use our access to the public, but they're trying to get as much information out. And we're going to let lieutenant governors be the arbiter of.
We wouldn't let them put the presentation in our water bill.
No. Oh, my goodness. No. Right?
Don't go many ideas.
So to restate what you just said, if you were the attorney, with this presentation coming, you wouldn't be comfortable that it's neutral enough.
No.
Okay.
No. Because facts are, I mean, if it's all numbers, numbers are easy, but it's so hard. Like just Jason's example of did you know, that characterization, but I'm very conservative on that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If their attorneys are fine with it, that's great.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Are we trained? We have certificates.
I have my certificate.
We forgot one item.
Oh, we forgot.
There's a page in there with our FOD hotline. The email works. Dustin recorded both him and me because they go to, if it's about the city manager or any of his employees, it goes to him or to me and vice versa to him. We tested it earlier today. It still works. It's in the book at the end of, I think, the open public meeting section. There's a page with just the link on it. So, yeah.
And just to report, we didn't receive any reports of fraud on the last year to that.
If it's on top, so it should just go. And your council, we have outside of the book little certificates if you wanted to hang them on your wall. We didn't want you to have to cut up your book.
Right in my office at the city.
Or if you wanted to make a copy and give them to the other board you're on and say, I received this training.
This is 2 hours.
Okay.
We're done here.
Yeah. So that a lot of times you're on other boards and stuff, and you can say, I'm going to skip that part of that meeting because I've already gotten it. So
I'm
surprised the mayor shows up to any of our trainings.
Yes.
I have had this training four other times.
It's beautiful.
Recently.
Was that Emily or is that you?
Tape it to my wall.
Emily and Anna put it all together. I had the
it's
idea for
nice.
The books and stuff, but they all credit Emily and Anna on really making it work. No, you don't get a certificate.
I can use it for my other boards that
I
sit on.
Oh, I thought you were thinking of the dartboard.
I have other
thank
boards
you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Require the same
thank you. Okay, we only have about 15 minutes for our next conversation.
We can cover it.
Budget is more time than that. But our next item is short-term rentals. And I know Jason Rasmussen, our assistant city manager, and our city attorney, Ryan Lewis, are going to be presenting that. Mr. Lewis.
Mayor, I'm just wondering, I know it's going to be quick. We had a lot of staff that worked on this that may have to make comments. They don't have as loud a voice as Ryan does to speak from the back row. Would it be possible to swap some seats so that the staff gets recorded on the recording? I would, if you guys are okay with that, I want to make sure that they get recorded. I would need Director Schaefer-Meyer, Director Priest, Chief Carr, I'm missing some people. Charity's not
Steven,
here.
Come and take my seat.
Chief Lesner, I know you're covering for Chief Dawson, but just in case. And I apologize for having to do that. I just want to make sure that they end up on the recording.
Well, we're going to talk about business licensing, potential business licensing.
All of these guys have a stake in this discussion because of how it affects operations in their departments.
That was a little short in my reach.
Okay.
Oh, Don, you're the other one I was missing.
So rude.
Really sad.
Don't worry. I invited him.
You should have heard it.
You're so kind and patient.
Don't stand.
So, Ryan's the source of all truth and knowledge, so I'll just get us started here. And
first and foremost, just like all credit went to Anna and Emily, Charity's really taking the labor and we're on this. I was pushing it for the last while. We've got more and more complaints in the last few years. 8-9 years ago, we had one complaint down on Chapel Ridge. that the parking was all taken for the Thanksgiving party, and that it's hard to make cookies every time a new neighbor moves in on short-term rental. Yes, those were actually said in meetings. And that was about the extent. In more recent years, we've had tour buses pull up. We've had people move out of neighborhoods because just this continual rotation. And it's become something that's hit the level of we should probably start to regulate. Now, we're not going to get deep into enforcement because the enforcement side, there's some statutory prohibitions, the what they call the not well language, that we can't use the posting itself. And then there's also some just staffing. How much can we get out and go after people we think are in violation or just regular checks if it's not reported? And so what we want to do here is before we get to enforcement, let's regulate it at a sensible level. And once we've got the right regulation, then we can look at how we enforce it and stuff. I can tell you, we've had recently Mr. Ray Liu, who asked you guys if he could continue using his tough shed that he put a hot plate in and I think a compost toilet and ran some water there. We just got a conviction 2 weeks ago where his building was in violation. The building was in violation and also the use of the building was in violation. And so we do prosecute these when people are not following the code. Now, Charity loved her slides. I'm not a big slide person as much. I don't make PowerPoints.
So, and as
but.
Ryan's changing, so I just mentioned some of these staff here. We were involved in a group and Charity kind of spearheaded it in coming up with these suggestions. So we have a pretty diverse spectrum of input that's been put into what's going to be shared with you.
The first recommendation we're going to make is we don't make it a land use issue for our wonderful planning commission for Steve to have to deal with. This is a city, from our perspective, it's a business issue, a business licensing issue. And so we don't see it as a use of the land. It's more because we don't regulate rentals. We regulate ADUs, that's a little different. But rentals themselves, if you rent your whole house out, you're not regulated, you can do that. But if you rent more than 4 units in the city out, you have to get a business license. It's been that way since about 2006-07. And so we would suggest that we regulate this through business licensing. Some cities may choose different, but that's how we would suggest it. There's some benefits and there's some drawbacks. You guys have the slide, I won't review it with you, but you could probably add to both lists, right? We want to balance people being able to use their property with how that use impacts everyone around them, right? And that's always what this body does when you start dealing with these neighborhood type issues and how people use it. Now, I happen to know that I'm pretty sure it's pretty close to your house, Council Member Harris. There's been an Airbnb type use going for a while. Senator Fillmore's told me about it. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I'm not sure which one you're referring
okay.
to.
Because he's referred, and he says it's been there for several years now and always been great to live next to and to have in the neighborhood. I know that in another neighborhood, we get every 3 or 4 months you've been getting contacted by the resident. As recently as 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and we told the resident about this meeting. And so it just depends on where you live and what you're dealing with and what the owner of that rental is doing with it.
And you received an email from that resident?
Yes.
It was forwarded by Anna, so if you haven't seen it,
oh, yeah.
You can read through it, and her contact information is there.
The one area this does interact with our land use code is that currently in our land use side on an ADU, we don't allow ADUs to be used for short-term rentals. We would suggest if we go into regulating business, business license, we would change this provision to allow them to be used. That's based on some of the suggestions for regulation we're going to propose. So the, oh, she just loved her slides. You know, this is that balance, right? Is where do you put people that come in to help your community spend money and stuff? So you have this both in the slide, and then I did a one pager of it because this is really what we're here for. We would suggest a few things that you look at, and we kind of put it in 3 buckets. And you can move things and adjust things and give us recommendations you think most fits the city. And so from a short-term rental standpoint, how many nights we do we require inspections? Do we limit occupancy? Do we require someone to live, like a manager, an agent, an owner to live in the house? Like ADUs, we can require that they live there, right? And so all of these are kind of a selection, and we can mix and match. You don't have to take column A, B, or C. You can move things from different columns, and we'd ask you to kind of think about that. So as we think about it, the first question in my mind that'll kind of determine a lot of the other one is the bottom one on the slide, and there's another slide, I just couldn't fit it all in there. But the bottom one is, do you as a council think that the owner or manager should live on the property or within 30 minutes, an hour, and that a sign be posted on the door? Or we're not too worried about where the owner manager lives and how they interrelate. Do you guys have any feelings on that?
I personally feel that they should. Well, I prefer the owner lives there, but I realize with how some people use the dwelling, it's not realistic, so that they should at least have a contact that can be there within an hour.
When you say it's not realistic, if you say that's a law, it is realistic.
Well, sure.
Because we're not, I mean, we could just prohibit them entirely.
But what their purpose is in having their short-term rental, and so
well, that's why
it might.
That's why we suggest we change the ADU. Yeah. So, for example, if you have an ADU in the house, it's more realistic, right?
Yeah.
There are people, especially in some cities, like I know in New York, they've cracked down on this a lot because of the whole hotel industry and stuff. But there was a long time there you could go on these sites and rent even down to a couch for a night. And they just had that level of engagement. I never tried that on my own, but where do you feel comfortable? Would you feel comfortable with someone on site at all times? Or would you feel more comfortable if there's someone within an hour or a half hour to address problems? In which case we would have them put a plaque on the door so when police got notice of a party or something, they show up, there's a plaque on the door, call here if there's a problem. Police can call and say your renters are out of control. I mean, we had one of these things in Draper not long ago, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, where there was actual shooting at a party. And so things can get out of control to the point where bad things happen.
So I'm looking at these, and you're saying 1 to 3 hours. I think that's tight. 72 hours, I think that's too long. My comfort zone would be 24 hours or less. Like if something's happening, you've got to be within 24 hours of responding. So that's not on here. That's my
yeah,
thought.
Yeah, we can write that in.
Off the top of my head.
Just realize by then the police have arrested and hauled everybody off. And
so I think that's such a large window.
I have to say the biggest complaint we get is that we can't get a hold of who is responsible for the property when we're dealing with a big, large party or something going on at these.
Okay.
Personally, I think if you have a manager or the owner lives on the property, they're going to control what's going on much, much better. I mean, when you have to live with what's going on, you're going to be way more selective.
And that could be a guest house situation or in the same house.
Yeah. You know, when you kind of look at other types of living establishments, so if you're staying in an apartment, there's going to be apartment managers, they'll take care of things immediately. If you're in a condo, there's a condo association with typically elected members who live there to be able to take care of situations. If you're staying in a hotel, you know, that's a temporary situation. You know, there's the, you know, the hotel staff that take care of things. You know,
ADU, we require.
ADU, there's someone there to take. This is the one scenario where that doesn't, I mean, doesn't really meet this. I mean, so we have the ability to be as restrictive, you know, as we want to in this. Is that right, Ryan?
Yeah. And remember, these sorts of businesses are competing with your hotels.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a flat out competition.
And they're in a residential area.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you live in a residential area, you expect to have a certain quality of life.
Yeah.
And I think if you bring in a business into where you're living, there it's reasonable to have some restrictions.
And there's a general sense that a long-term renter is more vested in that neighborhood than someone who's going to be there for a weekend.
True.
And so they may make decisions about how loud their party is or other decisions differently than someone who's going to be back in another state in 16 hours. So there are differences even among rentals between a short term and a long term.
So I know a lot of people who own short term rentals, who they live in our city, but they own short term rentals somewhere else, whether it's a Bear Lake or whether it's a St. George or whether it's Moab or, you know, you name it, whatever. They own short term rentals in some of those places and they are not an hour away. They are a couple hours away.
But we're not regulating them.
No, we're not. But what I'm saying is, who knows if there's people who live in St. George that own a short-term rental in South Jordan. We don't have nearly as many. We're not a resort community. We don't get to charge a resort tax. We don't. That's not a thing. We're not actually a super mega destination for short-term rentals, but we have some, and we do need to figure this out. But I don't – are there other communities? I don't think there are, that we have answers as to how many are saying you have to live in the house to rent it
it's
out.
It's kind of
that
all
really
over the map.
Negate the opportunity to even have a short term.
Well, there's some that just prohibit basically entirely, and it's just kind of all over the map. That's why we don't have something like we had with the commercial vehicles, like city by city, because resort communities are kind of in a different place. Washington County, everybody's got different ones based on their need, and it is very particular.
How many short term rentals do we estimate are in our city right now?
I'd have to run an AirDNA report, and I didn't get to that before this presentation, but I can do that. AirDNA is a company that if you were looking into doing short-term rental, you can order for, I can't remember how much money it is, a report, and that it would give you by zip codes, you know, how many are on there. They're pulling it from Airbnb, VRBO, and the
and
others.
Then from that list, let's say there's 50 or 100. Let's say there's 100 for easy numbers. Of those 100, are we estimating, and I know you don't know the answer, how many of those actually are getting a business license that are actually abiding by any rules?
None now because we haven't opened it. We would be proactively starting to reach out. When the police get somewhere and they find out it's a thing, we'd be using county records to find out who owns it. We'd be making contact.
So proactively be reaching out once this is decided.
And going to the mayor's point, one of the reasons why we wouldn't say the owner has to live there, it's owner or agent. Or owner or agent respond within X number of hours, as people do live in other places. And so that's where that agent comes in.
They could
in.
Contract with a neighbor to be their agent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
If you said
I'm
you
just
had
trying
to be there
think
in
realistically,
60 minutes.
A lot of people don't live in their Airbnb, right?
Yeah. But once,
and I don't have one, I don't own one, I don't have a dog in this fight that way. I'm just...
The reason I'm starting with that one is if you said they have to live there or live really close, or be responsive in a short period of time, then maybe your number of nights, you don't care because you've always got a responsible person there. But if your agent's far away, if it's a 72-hour type response time, then maybe you limit it to just the number of weekends in a year or something like that. You know what I mean? So you've got trade-offs in these arguments.
But we have no legal duty to offer these short-term rentals. I mean, this is just something that we're choosing to whether we allow or not allow, right?
Correct. Correct. There is an expectation, I will say, at some level, and because they've been around and stuff, that people doing it will be surprised by regulation. And if you just prohibit it all from A to Z, there's going to be people asking their legislators. Now,
we'll be made an example at the Capitol.
Possibly. But the legislature right now, the only bills out there are starting to swing toward limiting them because short-term rentals also really affect the affordable housing.
Yeah.
And they affect the other governmental policy interests too. And so they have a huge lobby. They're very strong. That's why they've maintained the protections they currently have. But they also haven't gained ground in stopping us from regulating at all and stuff. I would really think about a full prohibition from the standpoint of people's right to use their property.
Yeah,
but I would also balance that.
I didn't say that. I know. I just want to know what our duty was.
I'm just going
yeah.
with the scales
yeah.
here. I would try to find something that gives you the control to make this, keep the character and residential feel of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
While also balancing, you know, you cannot, and there's case law on this, stop people from just renting their house out permanently, you know, when they go from a starter home to the next home. You can't do that. That's a restraint on alienation.
My personal take is, I mean, just the nature of these short-term rentals, these owners don't know these people. A lot of times they're not doing full background checks on these people. Problems happen, just like police show up at our hotels in the city and have to address issues. There's things that will pop up. You know, at these places. And I think that in our city, I mean, we are, you know, I mean, you look at the type of the people who live in our city, we have, you know, overall, holistically, we have very good, you know, respectable people that live in our city. And when we have people that come into our city that choose not to behave that way, then yes, I mean, yes, our police are going to respond, but I also expect, you know, that we have responsive owners that are going to be taking action on these things. And I'd almost expect that the level of action be similar to, you know, if you had a hotel, you know, it's like, hey, they're going to be taking pretty swift action. They can get there pretty quickly and address the situation and take care of it. You know, they are competing with the hotels after all. And just to maintain who we are as a city. Do I think we should prohibit it? I'm not necessarily going there, but I don't want these problems lingering or, you know.
And if that's the direction we're given, that's easy for us to go back and start checking these boxes, bring that back to you guys for a view of it.
Having problem ones in my area, would having rules actually help the police? I'm assuming that it would help you to be able to deal with this and also help the residents who live around them.
They have lots of laws now they can enforce, like noise and stuff like that.
Right.
But then getting to the root of the problem, because you go out and you tell these people to be quiet this weekend, you got a whole new set next weekend.
Yeah.
The root of the problem is getting to the owner of the home and saying, you've got to get a business license, and the business license requires that you do these 10 things. Now you're dealing with a totally different way, police, fire. We can, like the first box in the corner there is inspection. We can check fire. We can check sleeping scenarios. Like, is it a real bedroom with a window, ingress, egress, meeting code? Or is this really a closet that's a 5x5 closet and they've thrown a mat on the floor because they get one extra room for somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these are important things. These are life safety things. Yeah, you know, for all we know, they're going to barbecue outside or have a fire pit and they're going to light the house on fire. It happens every year. People do that to their own homes, let alone one they're renting. So that's why fire is so important, business licensing, bragging, just how we approach it. So if you tell me, like a hotel, let's treat them like that, I can pick most of these out and bring something back to you.
I wish we had more time right now to talk
we
about this
it
because it's 6:30.
We can bring it back.
But I think we do need to think on this and come back and have more discussion about it.
Now that you have this sheet, I think you can start to give it some real thought about where you want to go, and we can have another discussion. So let's put it on another discussion.
It is great information. And these recommendations are just thrown out there. None of the numbers any number can fill it. It doesn't have to be 60 or 159. So it can be.
This is intended to give you what the spectrum looks like so that we can figure out where you want to go, then we can draft.
As I've talked to each of you over time, the general consensus I get is you want to regulate it at a fairly high level so that we don't have more people coming to you and saying, I'm moving because you're not doing anything. And so, you know, a couple of those are keys to that. The inspections keys, the owner-manager key. If we have a few things like that, then the number of nights doesn't matter as much because that owner manager is going to make sure they're not driving everybody out and there's no tour bus and things like that. And so a few things like that. If you want us to narrow down the list, whatever you want us to do, we're happy to do it. We just didn't want it sitting on our plate, not doing anything, because we know we're hitting a critical point with the residents where we really have to make sure their quality of life is preserved.
And if they don't comply and we pull their license, then that's one more thing we have if they don't have a license.
Yep.
And what can we do if they don't have a license? They refuse to get a business license.
We can prosecute.
Yeah.
It'd be just like if a commercial entity didn't get a business
license. Remember, we recently did that with some of the massage places around the city.
Yeah,
we pulled their licenses.
We're dealing with
and
that right now.
Yeah. We're dealing with exactly that scenario. We're going, you don't have a license, you can't operate your business, and we'll sit there until they lock the doors and leave.
Here's
and we cite them.
See the judge.
Yep.
Okay. This is really helpful information, good information. We want to get this right. This is important. I'm sure to all of our residents, we don't hear from all of them, but we have heard from quite a few that in spatterings here and there that this is something that we really need to make sure that we get right, and appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a fine balance.
It is. Yeah.
Our goal as staff is to make sure you have all the information. So if you don't see something on there, if you have more questions, reach out, let us know. And we'll bring this back at the next available meeting.
Perfect. Thank you.
Because once you give us a sense of where to go, we'll draft an ordinance to bring to you.
Okay. I'm going to ask if there is a motion to adjourn this meeting
here?
So we can make our way.
Yeah, someone's got a hand raised up there. This is work session, not a public hearing. We don't take public comment and stuff there. The next meeting will have public comment. If that person wants to make the public comment there, they're certainly welcome to.
Thank you, both.
Mayor, I'll make a motion that we adjourn.
I'll second that.
All right. All in favor, please say aye.
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 All right. This meeting is adjourned.